The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, where we're going to try to get to several, if not a multitude, of your questions today. Jim's got his nice pile of questions that have come in via email for the most part. If you'd like to send us a question, best way to do that is go to our website, jimhelps.com. On jimhelps.com, you're going to find a contact form on there. There's also a link right to the podcast website with some more information, as well as a way to reach out to us in a variety of ways, including sending us a question that you'd like us to answer on the show. So the questions that get answered most directly and most quickly are single topic questions that are direct, not too rambling or overly complicated with personal details. Just as a hint, sometimes we get questions that are voluminous, I guess you could say. There's a lot of words, a lot of detail. They're not really practical for covering on a Q&A show. So if you want your question, though, we enjoy answering those questions, and you can send them to us via jimhelps.com. So Jim looks like he has way too big of a pile of questions for us today. There's no way we're going to get through that entire pile. Oh, also, we need to find out from a few weeks ago how Jim's Thanksgiving with a butterball and jarred gravy went, because I forgot to ask him about that last week, although he's not really paying attention to me right now. So I make a prediction that people kind of enjoyed it, but they weren't willing to tell him to his face that they were disappointed. So what's the verdict?
Well, my butterball.
Your butterball and your jarred gravy, how'd that go?
Well, that ties into our very first question.
Really?
Which is more of a comment. And it's actually just came in recently, but I wanted to get to it because it has to do with Thanksgiving. And I know people are probably wondering, how did it all go? So he wrote, he said, I was cracking up driving to work this morning, listening to the Thanksgiving banter. Hmm. Very funny. Chris's
incredulity.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. About the gravy in the jar and the butterball was good stuff. Hmm. You will know. The butterball came out perfect.
I'm sure.
It did. Mm-hmm. It really did.
Yeah.
And I know you say I didn't need to
brine it.
Brine it. Mm-hmm. But I did. Mm-hmm. And it came out really, really good.
Good.
And then the cheaper turkey, because I thought I was going to have 25 people there, but not all 25 showed up. So someone took the cheaper turkey home. I just gave it to them. Mm. It came out good as well. Not as good as the Butterball.
Did you brine the other one too?
Brined it. So I would give huge kudos to brining. Anybody who wants to cook a turkey the old-fashioned way in the oven, I would definitely brine
it. Oh, that's the secret to glorious turkey.
The oven?
No, brining.
Oh, yeah.
When I discovered brining, it's been a long time now, but that was like, I don't know, it was like the discovery of the Ark of the Covenant or something. I mean, it was that level for me.
Yeah,
but I'm kind of into food, so.
Yeah, and you're into really expensive turkeys.
No.
Yes.
No. Not as.
How much was your turkey? Per pound.
Didn't have a turkey this year because we had just gotten in from vacation the night before, so we decided not to do the big shindig with the.
Okay.
This is the one Thanksgiving in my memory that I didn't cook a turkey. But traditionally, I pay $1.49 to $1.99 a pound.
For a fresh, never frozen turkey?
Correct.
Where are you getting it from? Joe's Used Turkeys?
Nope. Would you like me to tell you?
You said Sprouts. Sprouts sells them that cheap?
Absolutely. Yep, every year.
They can't be fresh, regular.
They are.
They're not wild turkeys running around.
They're not wild turkeys,
but I mean, you know, happy turkeys running around acreage.
They're just overpriced Whole Foods version of that same turkey.
Oh.
If you're comparing it to that, yeah, they're twice as expensive at Whole Foods for the exact same thing. In my opinion, I'm not, you know, I like Whole Foods for a lot of stuff, but I think their proteins are extraordinarily overpriced.
Okay, well.
Sprouts all the way.
I got mine at King Supers.
Yeah, and it was probably 79 cents a pound or something.
In the frozen food aisle.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that if you can't obtain the other. It's better than no turkey.
You know, growing up as a kid, Butterball was it. It was the preeminent turkey.
Oh, yeah.
If you had a Butterball.
And you had the little red thing that pops up, yeah, that tells you when it's clearly not done, but it's exciting to look at. Yeah.
But Butterball was it. Now apparently it's not. But the Butterball turkey went over well. Okay. I also want to report the 14 jars of gravy.
In the jars, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also went over well.
Did you take it out of the jars?
I took it out of the jars
before
first.
Before they got there.
My friend, I put him in charge of the gravy.
Yeah.
He clearly could not count the amount of people there, and he opened way too many cans. Mm-hmm. So we had bottles. Mm-hmm. We had way too much Heinz gravy than we needed, so I just refroze it. I put it back in the bottles put the bottles in the freezer.
Yeah.
So I think that'll work okay.
And people raved about the gravy. That's what you're telling me?
They did not complain, and they ate it.
That's a whole different level of satisfaction measurement there. Are you kidding? They didn't complain, and they choked it down. That is not... The gravy went over well.
In my book?
Did you ask anyone specifically about the gravy?
No.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, you had me all worried. But no one complained.
No.
They ate the turkey. They ate the gravy.
Having consumed Heinz jarred gravy before... I have served that in my home, not to guests, but to people that happen to live in my home, family, when I was in a hurry and had no other choice. You could have far worse gravy, for sure. I've had homemade gravy worse than that.
See?
So, yes.
So, there was no complaints, which to me is the same thing as
nice.
A
rave review.
I'm
glad it went well. I'm glad it went well.
The best part was at in the morning, I still had 25 people signed up.
I thought you were about to say I still had 25 people in my living room in the morning.
No, God, no. Everybody was gone by 6 o'clock. And I started worrying that two turkeys wasn't going to be enough, big turkey and little turkey. So the night before, I took out an elk roast, and I made an elk roast. And that
went over.
Oh,
huge.
That got all the rave reviews. And it was gone.
There's your signal the Butterball wasn't that great.
I had it. Well, no, it's because it's turkey. People are like, that's turkey. Let's have some elk roast. And it just went over really well. People were very, very impressed with my cooking skills on the elk roast.
Yeah.
So that was a huge hit. So
elk is an underappreciated meat.
Oh, yeah. For those who don't hunt and have never had elk, you don't know what you're missing. You should take up hunting.
Or know someone who hunts and get elk from them.
And get elk
from
them.
Which is what I do.
Which is, yes. But anyways, so I want to thank this listener that he was wondering about the turkey, and that gives you an update on the turkey.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get into questions. We got two questions in, and I'm jumping them to the top of the line, even though they don't begin with Go Pats, because they had to do with our 60-day rollover strategy. We keep getting questions in on that. So trying to find, I got one of the questions. I can't find where the other one is. I'll read the first one, and then you can start opining, and then I'll look for the second one. But, oh, here it is. Okay, I knew there was a second one. All right, second one really isn't, it's kind of related, but it's more of a tax question. Okay, so the first question was, hi, Jim and Chris. You have discussed the concept of constructive receipt as it relates to your 60-day rollover, as it relates to 60-day rollovers. Mm-hmm. Would the information in the article below change those rules? It seems that for the purpose of inclusion in gross income, it goes based on when the plan cuts a check. So if the participant is on vacation, it won't help. Would you say that this concept will apply to the purpose of starting the 60-day clock as well? And I know y'all aren't going to know what he's talking about, so I went and read the article, which references a revenue ruling that the IRS came out with in August. The article actually references Ed Slott. And I didn't mention it on our 60-day rollover show because it only applies to 401ks, and Chris and I are talking IRAs. But it also doesn't apply. In fact, if anything, Chris, it solidifies our approach. It doesn't cause any, in my opinion, ambiguity on when the 60 days begins. Let me explain. What the IRS came out with was Revenue Ruling 2019, which means it came out in 2019, -19, which means it was
The 19th, the issued
revenue ruling. Mm-hmm. Okay. So revenue ruling 2019-19, which came out on August 14th. It would be cool if it came out on the 19th, wouldn't it?
And of the 19th month. That'd be really cool.
Well, we don't have 19 months.
I was just testing you. I thought I was going to get you on that one.
No, sir. I'm a little too smart for that. Okay. What it does, Chris, it really was designed, listener, and listeners in plural, it was really designed to help 401k plans understand their reporting requirements, not really to help plan participants. To back up a little, Chris and I did a show. Which one was it? 1938? You found the number of the show not too long ago. Was it 19? It was 19-something.
I'd have to go back and look.
It doesn't really matter. Yeah. But we came out with the show, I think it was October now, sometime in October, so a couple months ago. And we do it once a year. We did it last year, we did it this year, most likely we will do it next year. And it's just a way. Listen to the show. I don't want to get into it on today's podcast. But listen to that show, and it's just a way to buy yourself a little bit of time on doing a Roth conversion. Because a Roth conversion happens when money leaves your IRA. That's when the IRS considers, and this is crucial to this revenue ruling, Chris. The IRS considers the conversion to happen when money leaves an IRA.
Right. If you finalize the conversion ultimately, because when it leaves the IRA, that's just a distribution initially. When you then turn around and put it in the Roth IRA, thus consummating the conversion, the IRS says, oh, you have completed a conversion, and we're going to consider it having happened when the money left the IRA back at the beginning of the story.
Correct. So in our strategy, you actually take money from your IRA towards the end of the year. We also explained that I have yet to see an IRA custodian that doesn't do it this way. When they send you the check, they debit the account by that dollar amount and record it as distributed on that day, right, not the day you actually cash the check. And this ties in to the revenue ruling. Mm-hmm. So it's a good thing this guy picked it up, but it applies to 401ks, not IRAs, and we're talking about IRAs. But anyways, I'll go back to his question in a second. So the whole strategy works by saying, okay, the conversion actually is considered to be done if, as Chris said, you complete it by putting the money into a Roth. The IRS will consider it done on the day it leaves the IRA, not the day it goes into the Roth IRA. And most custodians will debit the IRA on the day the check is sent to you, not when you cash it. And we explain that. That's just how they do their accounting. There's a word for it. I can't remember what the word is, but there's a banking word for that, because this isn't a real bank account like you have at a real bank, where they're not going to debit your account, Chris, until the check is cashed, not when the check is written. But if you go to your bank and ask for a certified check, they will debit your account the day you pick up that certified check, not the date that certified check gets cashed. So your IRA operates similar to that. Okay, so in this revenue ruling, the IRS wanted to make it perfectly clear that when you request a distribution from your 401k, the distribution is considered done and taxable in the year you took the distribution, not when you cashed the check. So if you took a distribution towards the end of the year, 401ks were confused. If the check doesn't get cashed, are we supposed to report
it
this
as last year or
on,
this year?
Or do we wait until the check gets cashed? So this revenue ruling was really designed to help 401ks say, hey, what it is when a participant calls or emails or however they do it and takes money from their 401k, when you debit the money out of the 401k and send it to them, it is taxable in that year, whether or not the recipient cashes the check.
Right.
So if the recipient waited a year to cash the check, so be it. It's not taxable in that year. Send your 1099 for the year that the money came out. That's all.
And for a distribution, the same rule would apply to an IRA. When you call up and ask for the distribution and they send the distribution, it becomes a distribution as of that year, that tax year, even if you don't receive the check until later in January.
But the IRS had never given clarity on this. They finally did. So this listener was wondering, would constructive receipt, therefore, be considered when the money is distributed from the account, he asked, or when the check is cashed? And it's neither. The constructive receipt that Chris and I are talking about with our strategy, not so much this revenue ruling, which in the article listener you gave to me and another article from the same publication the following month, in both those articles, they do reference or do admit that this applies only to 401ks. There is no clarity yet if it will apply to an IRA. But it's immaterial.
Even if it did, I don't think it's going to change how this works.
No, it's not going to change because under the rules, the 60-day clock begins, and the IRS is clear on this and the tax code is clear on this. The 60 days begin when you take ownership or claim of that check. And there are private letter rulings, which I admit are not as powerful as a revenue ruling, which applies to everyone. But there are private letter rulings, Chris, of people being granted relief because the check doesn't arrive for months. The post service screwed up. One person, again, was in jail. Another person from a private letter ruling that Ed Slott reviewed with us was committed to an alcohol recovery type thing, involuntarily committed. And he had requested a rollover, and he got committed before he got that check. And the IRS has consistently ruled the 60 days will begin when you take control of that check. Now, they could very easily change their opinion or could have very easily said the 60 days begins when you request it, not when you receive and cash it.
Currently, that's not the rule.
It's not the rule. And I think they're being fair because, I mean, nowadays everything is done electronically, I admit. And this is one reason why we specified in our strategy to ask for a paper check. It buys you a little more time. But constructive receipt is considered when the electronic deposit happens. Is no doesn't matter if you knew it was in your account or not. When that money goes into your account, the 60-day clock begins. But with a paper check, it's when you physically touch the check. And this is what Ed keeps pointing out. And if you're on vacation, if you never get the check, if the check is sent to the wrong address and it takes that person 3 weeks to come give it to you, the 60-day clock doesn't begin until you touch the check. He was wondering if this revenue ruling, which says it's taxable in the year it's distributed, not the year the check is cashed, if they would apply that to the 60-day rule. Right now, they haven't.
No, and taxes aren't actually ever based on constructive receipt. People get paid all the time for the last part of December. They don't get their check from the employer until
true.
The first part of January. That doesn't make it January taxable.
And that's
it's
what they're
still
trying to
December.
Clarify.
So they're just clarifying what happens with other types of income that's taxable. It happens when there's this final date when you actually have earned it or have it's been distributed to you, not when you actually receive it. That's a whole different thing. The constructive receipt hasn't anything to do with the taxation of this. It has to do with the starting of the clock.
Exactly.
And they've defined in there the start of the clock is at constructive receipt. That's why constructive receipt is an issue in our timing of that clock. But it has nothing to do with it. This was an argument about when are the taxes generated and what tax year is the income recognized. That's completely separate from a 60-day clock.
Correct. And if you follow the logic here, Chris, excuse me, if you follow them, because it's taxable in the year it's distributed, that also explains why they're considering the conversion to happen in the year it's distributed,
right.
Not the year it's put in. Just like they're saying, it's taxable in the year it comes out of the 401k, not the year the recipient cashes the check.
Yeah.
The conversion is considered happening in the year it's distributed, not the year it's put in.
Right, and they were preventing a lot of paperwork nightmare because if people were going to take money out and then and be taxed on it in say 2018, and then have a have to have an offset to that, but because they ultimately put it in a Roth in January of 2019, talk about a paperwork nightmare, if you will. They've
well,
got
the 1099s
here.
And the 5498s wouldn't match up.
No, but and then you'd have to explain why you're making a... and then you'd have to argue that it's not really a contribution over my limit. It's actually really just me putting the money back in. They alleviate that with this rule by making the conversion effective the day it's distributed. It eliminates that timing problem as you're crossing
absolutely.
Between tax years. So it makes perfect sense why in the code, in the rules, it specifies that the conversion is dated then. Separate from that, they had to define, well, when the heck does this 60-day we keep referring to, when does that clock start? And they could have chosen anything. They could have chosen when it leaves. They decided instead to be more fair to the taxpayer, because if there is a huge delay in receiving it, that wouldn't be fair to certain people. If you get it immediately, it's not a problem. But if there's a delay, some people might only get 45 days. And someone probably said, well, that's not fair. So let's start the clock when they receive it. And everyone at the table said, okay, that sounds reasonable. Let's make that the rule. And that's the rule today. Could be changed, but that's the rule today.
Okay, so I thought that was an interesting question. I bumped it to the top of the list because it tied into the 60-day rule.
Plus, it's timely.
This is another 60-day one that is also timely, and that's why I wanted to get to it. And I don't quite know. This is it's a case of someone taking us a little too literally. So we run into that a lot.
Okay.
So it begins. Marilinda here, age 27. I was
a young pup.
A young pup, as they say. Mm-hmm. I was hoping the Pats would have converted on fourth down last night. So you see, he's trying to get... Mm-hmm. Of course, he is mentioning this, I believe, he was talking about when we lost to the Baltimore Ravens. So he's lucky I'm reading this. And I want to point out, have you seen the news today where they're trying to throw my Pats under the bus again? The collective cheaters again?
it's from the reputation that they're being scrutinized more heavily.
Have you seen what is going on?
The thing with Cincinnati?
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, if it is true, now Belichick is saying, look, the company that does that
I'm
and
not
produces
a fan,
that,
and I think it's an innocent issue.
Well, he's saying, look, we have no control over that. Right. We don't run that. It's not us, even though they're doing it.
And the idiots decided to turn the camera on the field when they should have been on the
booth. He's saying, honestly, I don't know. Mm-hmm. My point is, if Belichick is lying and the Pats were doing this on purpose, do you really have to cheat on an 11-1 team?
One and 11 team. Yeah, you think.
I think the Pats, even though we're sucking wind this year, can do pretty good against the Bengals without needing to film their coaching crew. But anyways, goodness, it's all over the news today. Even the local news was picking it up and throwing my Pats under the bus that we're a bunch of cheaters. So if your email begins with Pats are a bunch of cheaters, don't even write anything after that.
Top of the list.
No, it's not on the top of the list.
That's fair.
At the bottom of the list. I'll be reading it in 4 years. Anyways, he begins, Marylander here, age 27. Was hoping the Pats would convert on fourth down last night. Then he begins with his question. In your 60-day conversion podcast a few weeks ago, you joked that you hope nobody uses H&R Block. But I get it. Apparently, I think he was talking about you, not me.
No.
I think so. I think the you even. There is you.
Use guys.
Use guys. Now, that's a New Englander, because we say that. Use guys. But
I don't remember talking about it.
Well,
go
let
ahead.
Me finish this damn
okay,
email,
sorry.
Will you? He says, I get it free through my military one source, and that is what I use. So what is wrong with it? This is going to be my first tax year filing as married, and I'm considering going to a tax pro. I assume that is something you would recommend, but how do I even find a good one here in California? Well, that's weird, a Maryland. Military. So he's probably from Maryland, but lives in California. First thing, listener, I think you're okay, especially if you're getting it for free. If Chris did
We don't have anything necessarily against H&R Block. The only thing it could possibly have been is we were talking about complicated tax strategies, and we wouldn't probably recommend a mundane run of the mill, and we referred to H&R Block kind of as the, like we would say, Kleenex instead of tissues.
The
right?
One thing I will point out with H&R Block, the offices and the person doing your taxes are probably not a CPA or an enrolled agent. They're a tax preparer trained by H&R Block to use their software to really just pump in answers to questions that are fed to them through their computer terminal. Mm-hmm. And I question the true value on a complicated return of their service. I think for the masses who just don't have the desire, knowledge, or ability or inclination to do their own taxes, but don't have anything too complicated, I think they would be fine. Mm-hmm. I will say I had the unfortunate displeasure of hiring a former H&R Block employee who did not impress me much at all with their tax knowledge, and I think you would agree on that. You know who I'm talking about. Would I blame H&R Block for that? No, this was more of the former employee. This is going back a while. The former employee's failure, I think, to keep up with tax laws and better himself. But he had been at H&R Block for a very long time, and in hindsight, I wonder, what the hell was he doing there? How can they pick up on what we picked up on pretty quickly? He wasn't that knowledgeable in taxes. So I don't want to use that as a way to throw H&R Block under the bus. If you've got millions of dollars and you're doing a complicated return, you might want to get a little better tax preparer on board. But you're a 27-year-old military person. You probably don't have a very difficult tax situation. Mm-hmm. And I think they're probably going to do a fine, fine job for you.
Yeah. And I personally, I don't recall saying anything one way or another about them, but we must have if they brought it up.
I think it was you. I think it was
no,
me.
No, you say things off the cuff.
I don't
like
say
that.
Anything off the cuff. I am straight and narrow, like an arrow.
Uh-huh. Butterball.
Okay, but anyways, I wanted to get to that because it's kind of tied in. I don't want you to go out, especially listener. Just and again, H&R Block and the other one there, like Liberty and a couple of the other ones, isn't there
Jackson
another
Hewitt.
One, Jackson Hewitt? Mm-hmm. Their niche isn't our do-it-yourself listeners with $3 million in an IRA and a complicated deferred comp plan. That's not really their niche. They're going after people just like you, listener. Someone who has a fairly straightforward situation, and they're trying to provide a reasonable service at a fair price. Now, that's going to be up to you if the service is reasonable and the price is fair. But I think any of those big three tax preparation services would be fine for you. You, on the other hand, should avoid, and here's where I'm going to get in trouble from the other side of the tax prep aisle, a high-priced CPA. You don't need someone with those three initials. I'm sorry, you don't. And you're going to be overpaying if you were to go out and hire a CPA tax professional to do the tax return of a 27-year-old newly married military person. I don't envision your taxes being that complicated. Now, I could be totally wrong, and you got a lot of funky stuff going on. But if you don't, I think you'd be well served with any of the big three or big four or big five tax preparation companies, mm-hmm. at least at this phase in your life. What are your thoughts, who threw H&R Block under the bus?
Would you stop? I don't think I said that. I'm going to go back and look.
Well, he said you.
Use.
He didn't say use. He said you. Mm-hmm. And you would be you, not me, because me would be me.
Well, I'm going to read it next time, so it's you next time.
Okay. Let's get
into cruising.
We are going through two anyways. Okay. This one is a pretty good one.
Okay.
It is titled Living on Basis, Go Pats, followed by what looks to be almost 37 exclamation points.
I don't think that should get them farther up in the queue. Exclamation points. Anybody can type that.
This is from almost 2 months ago. So it didn't really get them up into the
no,
queue.
No, apparently not.
Sorry. It begins, Dear George Clooney, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to your very brilliant I like this already. Your very brilliant comments on your recent podcast.
It's possible to over-schmooze. Just people, just come on.
Was it the 37 exclamation points?
37, George Clooney, brilliant. Those are, that's
go
a
Pats.
Little overboard.
I kind of like this email. I think we may frame it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Dear George Clooney, Jim, I was listening to your very brilliant comments on your recent podcast. Tell Chris that this is a real email. I was intrigued by the phrase living on basis. I'm in a situation where I have a large taxable portfolio and thought in order for me to cash anything out of it, I would have to pay capital gains taxes. Can you please expand on your strategy of living on basis? Because I think you were being too pithy. See, he's right. I am too pithy. Most of my portfolio is in stocks with capital gains, as well as index funds with capital gains. Thanks for all you do, Georgie Girl. That was cute, Georgie Girl. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a song? Hey there, Georgie Girl.
I don't know if that's what it's called, but...
I think that's a song. I don't know if it's called Hey There, Georgie Girl, but I think the line is Hey There, Georgie Girl. Or is it Hey There, something else?
That sounds reasonable.
I think it's Georgie Girl. I'll have to Google that. Anyways, George E. Girl, I'll let Chris feel free to expand on this as well. There is a way to live on basis, even if you have individual stocks, individual ETFs with embedded capital gains, if your custodian who's holding those assets is using specific share identification as the accounting method. I would assume if you are owning individual equities, they will be using specific share identification. I would be shocked.
If they're not, if you have personal records of the purchase lots on them, can't you still get away with it?
Well, Joe's not here, and she's counseling with someone right now, so we can't drag her upstairs. But I believe you would be, because the problem is going to be the basis is going to get reported as one thing on your 1099, and you're going to be reporting another thing.
Yeah.
So I don't know how that would mesh. I would imagine the IRS would allow you to say, hey, I'm going to use my own and be prepared for a letter audit. Mm-hmm. But I'm not 100% certain on that. And that's what we would have Joe here for. But again, she's counseling with
it's
someone
obviously
right now.
Best if the custodian is tracking it for you. So you then can specify which shares you want to sell, and they will have the basis attached to those shares.
Right.
And you can control that.
Because especially on the ETFs you talked about, not so much on the equities, unless the equities were involved in a DRIP plan, which is a dividend reinvestment plan, where you bought equities and then all the dividends are buying fractional shares of those same equities. It is possible you might be in a DRIP plan. I don't know. But specific share identification, average share, first in, first out, last in, last out, last in, first out, first in, last out. These are all different types of accounting measures. The government ruled in 2010, I believe it was, they passed the law, it was 2009
right
or 10. And then they gave the industry several years to catch up to speed. Mm-hmm. Prior to the government ruling, you, listener, had to keep track of your basis and what accounting method you were going to use. Well, the IRS got fed up with it because people weren't keeping good records and people were gaming the system.
Yep.
And they also knew, they being the IRS, also knew that computer technology was finally at such a level where custodians, who for years were saying, there's no way we can track this, it would be too hard. Custodians couldn't make that claim anymore. So the IRS said, look, you, meaning custodians, have to start tracking basis and reporting to us, meaning the IRS, what the basis of these investments are when you sell them, so we, meaning the IRS, can tax the hell out of the people who own it and tax them correctly. So what you have found yourself in is you've got this taxable account where there's a lot of basis in there, which represents money you've already paid taxes on. You would love to live on that for a variety of reasons. A lot of people like to do it to keep their income low. If you're just spending basis, then you're going to have very low income taxes that year, and maybe you'll qualify for ACA premium tax credits. That's the big one we see.
Well, I think he wants you to expand on that, what you just said, living on basis. It's not quite, people might be envisioning, oh, I just want to tell them to send me the basis only. That's unfortunately not what we're saying.
No, it doesn't work that way.
What you're going to have to identify are specific shares, usually clumps of shares that were all bought at the same time that will have the same basis. We call them a lot. So not a space lot. And that share lot will have a certain cost basis assigned to it based on what you purchased it for originally. And if you're picky and choosy, you can select things from your portfolio that maybe don't have a lot of embedded gain in them, which simply means stuff that hasn't performed very well or that you've bought more recently doesn't have a lot of gain in it versus something that was bought 20 years ago and has a whole bunch of gain in it that would be taxable. So you can't cut the basis from the gain and sell just the part of the share that's basis. That's not possible.
Nope.
But you can selectively choose items from your normal taxable accounts to minimize how much gain you're going to realize upon the sale of them by specifying the share lots that have the most favorable cost basis compared to their current price. That's what we're talking about.
And if you're really good at it and you do your homework, you can actually declare some gain as well that will be tax-free if you can keep your income in the 12% tax bracket. You might be able to exempt some or all of the capital gain from taxation. Now, if you have any other accounting method except specific share identification that will allow you to specific share allows you to cherry pick, I want this share and that share and this share. Now, it's a pain sometimes. Some custodians make it easy because they do it electronically, but you have to type in the lot number and the purchase date and the number of shares. although I have seen some custodians now, Pershing is one of them that I saw recently, they have little check boxes next to every share you want.
Yeah.
And you just check instead of having to type it in.
Right.
In the olden days, and olden mean going back just 5-6 years ago, you had to type it all in by hand and specifically identify which ones they are. Now they got little check boxes. And a lot of them, as you start checking the boxes of the specific shares you want to sell, they're showing you your total gain, your total basis. Don't forget, you might be able to specifically identify shares that might cost you a $10,000 capital gain, listener, but free up $80,000 of total basis. And if that $10,000 is the only money you declare that year of income, it'll probably be tax-free because capital gains are tax-free in the 12% and lower bracket. Yet you freed up $80,000
to live on.
Of basis to live on.
Yeah.
So with specific share identification, you can start getting into this level of share choosing and control your taxable income to maybe make it more advantageous to convert to a Roth IRA or to qualify for ACA premium tax credit. Those are the two instances where we see it most here in our office. But if you don't have specific share identification, if they use average share price, which is what you often see with ETFs and mutual funds, not necessarily equities, but if they use average share price or first in, first out, last in, last out, last in, first out, first in, last out, what that's referencing is, hey, if they do FIFO, first in, first out accounting, they're going to say, look, the very first shares you bought are the very first shares you're selling, irrespective of what's going on. First in, first out. Last in, last out, that reduces your taxes for the most part short term because the last shares that you purchased will be the first shares to be sold, and they haven't really gained that much yet.
Yeah. He meant last in, first out, if he didn't say that.
Oh,
he said
I
it so many
that?
Times now it's
I
blurred.
Remember.
I thought you said
I
last
know.
In, last out. But
who knows? It's not what I say, it's what I mean.
I get it, yeah.
But you need to find out, listener, from your custodian what type of accounting they're doing. If they're not going to give you specific share identification and that's what you want, you may need to change custodians and then make sure the new custodian, because basis will transfer from one custodian to the next, make sure the new custodian will take your basis information and accept it and enter it in there. But I would talk to your custodian first, find out what they're using for accounting. And anyways, that's how you, quote unquote, live on basis.
Yeah, and most of those accounts, during the, if you had assets in there prior to the transition to this, they would have sent you a letter asking you, notifying you of this, and oftentimes asking you your preference if they offered choices in accounting methods. They would have a default. They would say, we're going to default you to this unless you tell us something else.
Most do give you that, so I'm going to assume they got that,
right,
and they chose something.
Or
she
got
just
defaulted
right.
into something, yeah.
She just doesn't remember. Okay. All right. Okay, let me get into this one because it's something that I ended up doing recently and this listener kind of misunderstood, or I might have misspoke. This goes back, remember when I told you when I was on my way to elk hunting, I was talking to a colleague of mine who hunts with me, his name's Bill, and Bill was explaining how he reduced the taxes on some very, I said that they were, I believe I said that they were deferred comp that this person was receiving and that Bill had reduced the taxes. Well, it wasn't deferred comp, and we cleared that up on a subsequent podcast. But I'm going to clear up a little bit more of what Bill did and what I recently helped someone try to do. So this person writes, hi, Jim. On your Q&A show 1939, you described a strategy of creating a defined benefit pension plan and funding it with distributions from a severance payment. I'm 61 years old and will be receiving $185,000 in severance in 2019 and $118,000 in 2020. Is this strategy something that may work for me? If so, can you provide me the name of the consultant that you mentioned? And then he signed it his real name, but again, we're going to call him George to protect his anonymity. Well, George, I got bad news for you. It is not for severance. It is for actual income. What my colleague did, he cleared the air when I got this. I called him. I was like, Bill, can you explain to me one more time what the hell it is you did? So Bill has an attorney client who years ago referred a case to another law firm. And then that law firm took the case and took it to trial. The attorney had retired but maintained a consulting business. Okay? And on the side, he would consult. Some of the consulting work he did was to his wife's real estate firm. But he just had a small consulting business. This year, was it this year or last year? This year. This year, the case he referred out was settled, and the attorney was to receive $600,000 as his fee for the referral out. What Bill got, the firm that is paying his client to do, was spread the $600,000 instead of all in 2019. They gave him half in 2019, and they're giving him half in 2020. So now this gentleman is getting $300,000 and $300,000. Still the same
six. Of consulting income.
Of consulting income. That's the
key.
To his
business. Yeah.
This was a business income. It wasn't what you have, listener. Severance. Severance is not consulting income. It's just, hey, you were a great employee. Thanks for all your help. When you leave, don't let the door hit you on the way out. But we're also going to give you some money taxable to you as income.
Yeah, it's just more income. They call it severance, but it's just more income to you personally. The only way you could get around this is if somehow you could get the company you're leaving to agree to hire you as, instead of paying me severance, hire my consulting firm as a consultant for the next 2 years.
And pay and me a consulting
Pay me that way, and then you could open the door to this strategy here.
Correct. So what Bill ended up doing, if this gentleman, if this attorney had received $600,000 in 1 year, he would have been in the near top bracket. Actually, they would have been, because that would have been enough to put him and his wife in the top bracket. So instead, what Bill did is he got a hold of this other consultant who creates defined benefit plans for self-employed people. Now, the strategy only works if the self-employed person has no employees or just a spouse employee. It works wonderful. Right. If you have an employee, it gets a little bit more difficult, especially
you're gonna have to fund their pension
if you have multiple employees. So what Bill ended up having done is first got the law firm to pay, instead of in 1 year, in 2 years, $300,000 a year. Then Bill stopped, and the defined benefit consultant took over. And it's a woman. I've already talked to her. She is willing to come on our podcast, by the way, and talk at length about this strategy. Maybe we'll bring her on. So what she did for Bill's client is she helped him create a defined benefit pension plan. Because this gentleman is already in his 60s and the pension plan has to pay out at retirement age, the amount he had to put in to fund his pension was quite high.
Yeah, but he was more specifically, the amount he was allowed to put in in a particular
and
year
that's
was
where
quite
I was
high.
Going. Because they
it can be justified actuarially.
Yeah, it does. It has to be justified actuarially, and it's capped. So he was allowed to put in about 230,000 or so. Don't quote me on that. It's it was high. It was 200 something thousand. I believe Bill said 230,000, but I could be wrong. The defined benefit plan has to be funded for 3 years. So out of the 300,000 that's coming in, 230 goes into the defined benefit plan, and boom, it goes in tax deductible to the company.
Yep.
So the company earns 300,000 but gets to deduct the 230,000 it's got to put in.
Pension. Yep.
Next year, 2020, it's going to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. In 2021, the consultant has determined they need, the attorney needs to put $50,000 in. Well, there's, I said to Bill, what if there's no income? What if he doesn't get a consulting job? What if there's no income? He says, well, remember, he has his wife and he consults for her. And I know, Bill is saying this, I know she is going to need some consulting work in 2021. And I bet you it just happens to cost $50,000. So he will have then $50,000 coming in consulting income mm-hmm. from his wife's business, because apparently she's going to need that kind of assistance.
Right.
And that will take care of the final contribution right. that this defined benefit plan needs to make. Then the plan is going to fold. It's going to close. The plan is no longer going to be offered. And there will be close to $230,000, $460,000, $510,000. The plan has an expected return of 5%. I have found that this is crucial as well. The plans are based on a certain expected return. So the plan has chosen, and the actuarial assumptions are assuming, a 5% return. Now, if the return deviates greatly from that, the amount you're allowed to put in might be significantly higher or lower. So you really want a low volatile, not a lot of investment volatility while the plan is around, because it's operating like a true pension, Chris, mm-hmm. a true defined benefit. But when the plan folds...
Well, it doesn't fold. It
well,
just
the plan
closes.
Is going to close. When the plan folds or closes, whatever word you want to use, the attorney is then going to transfer as a lump sum distribution, tax-free, to his IRA...
Tax-deferred.
Tax-deferred. Yeah. The entire $510,000 plus whatever growth or losses have been attributable to it, mm-hmm. and will transfer that into an IRA. Yeah. And then what Bill has successfully helped this person do is take a huge amount of income that a lot of it would have been lost in taxes and at least defer it. Because he's going to have to take RMDs, and I did point that out to Bill. I was like, this is going to create more of an RMD nightmare in a few more years when he turns 70.
But at least it gets spread out instead of just hammering
him in
2 years.
But he gets it spread out. Yeah. And that was the key. He didn't need the money all at once. He is going to have to pay taxes on it. He knows it. Bill mm-hmm. didn't get him anything tax-free. He's just given him time to liquidate that money out of the IRA a lot slower.
I will tell you, that seems overly complicated to me, because maybe they wouldn't agree to this, but one would think if he could negotiate with the other firm, oh, I know you owe me $600, but would you delay that and pay me as $300? That's the law firm would love to keep that money longer, you'd think. And if you came to them and said, would you please pay me $100 every year for six or something like that, let them string it out for you, no cost. Now you won't get any kind of gains or anything on it while that's happening, but that's, you know, it seems kind of I like the approach. I think it's very creative. I think it might be, for most people, it's probably overly complicated. For most people, it's not going to work anyway. This is very unique circumstances
for
them. But knowing it's out there might get some creative juices flowing if you're listening and you have a somewhat similar situation. But oftentimes, and we see this with severance as well. People are so freaked out about losing their job that whatever severance package, they don't ask to negotiate it. And part of that negotiation, and a lot of times they will say no, but it's worth asking, would you, instead of paying me as a lump sum, would you spread this out at least between a couple of tax years or three tax years or something like that? And they may very well be fine with that.
My only concern with that, and I agree totally, perhaps this attorney could have approached the law firm and maybe negotiated paying it out. Or again, I'm certainly not a payroll expert. Are they allowed to do that? I don't know. I have no idea what kind of agreement was signed. What's beneficial for them tax wise? Is it to get all this off our books so we can deduct it as an expense rather than carrying it? I mean, I don't know the answer to a lot of that. I know the strategy is it sounds complicated, but there's a person recently who I sent to this consultant because they have a real estate development company, and it's just a husband and wife and son. Mm-hmm. And because their employee is a son and very, very young, it kind of worked out okay in their situation, the consultant explained. But they were making quite a bit of money right now, and they're expected the same next year and possibly even in beyond that. And they were looking to get as much into a retirement account and lower their taxable income this year. And this worked mm-hmm. beautiful. Mm-hmm. And it was married to a 401k. So they're going to be able to fully fund the 401k and about $130,000 for each husband and wife in as a defined defined benefit plan contribution to the pension, as well as both of them fully funding their 401k, and their 401k was designed to allow after-tax contributions and in-service conversions. Mm. So it has all the bells and whistles that we were talking about that a good 401k would have.
Right.
Well, this consultant helped this person start to put all this in place. Mm-hmm. So it can work, but in both cases, it's income from self-employment that's being shielded mm-hmm. and thrown into the defined benefit plan. It's not severance.
Right. Which, if designed properly, that defined benefit plan can, you can choose the lump sum rollout into an IRA. So you ultimately get it out in your control as if it were to just have gone into the IRA almost in the first place. So it was just taking certain steps and having certain structures in place to have it end up flowing into there instead of being all taxed as it came into the consulting business or the self-employment business
right.
in the first place. So
now if anyone out there now, because it doesn't help this listener, if anybody out there has a situation similar to what I described, similar to my colleague Bill's situation where his client was getting a huge amount of income as a self-employed person through a referral, or someone like the people that I just referenced who are working but doing very, very successful with their business. The only employees are the husband and wife, the two spouses, and a child. It's not multiple employees. It blows up the more employees you have. But if you fall into either of those, get a hold of me, send me on an email, and I will send you this consultant's information. She's a very nice woman. But when I was chatting with her, I asked her if she would come on the podcast. We're going to try to get her on the podcast after the holidays to talk about this, to get into the weeds more. Mm-hmm. I gave a very 30,000 mm-hmm. foot when I attended her phone calls with the people that I sent over to her to see if she could help them. She's like, she gets really into it and just was explaining to him all the rules and there are a lot of rules that need to be followed. Her firm gets compensated by being paid to set up these plans mm-hmm. and then maintain them on an annual basis. I will say I was surprised. I found her fees were extremely reasonable. They were not more than a few thousand dollars to get this all set up. I was
really,
I couldn't believe it. It was not that expensive.
See, I was imagining much more than that.
No, so was I. It wasn't. I think the total was less than $5,000, probably less than $4,000. And then annually, it was less than $2,000. So I was impressed with what the costs were and her level of knowledge of how the rules work, how adding an employee is going to change things, how the son can fit into this, how both spouses can fit in. It just, this is all this person does, and they knew the rules and how to file everything, and her firm takes care of it all. So I was pretty impressed by all of that.
Nice.
Okay. So this one, that one's be too long.
Yeah, we have time for one more if it's not too long.
All right, there's this one looks long, but the question is actually quite straightforward. So it begins, "Hi, Jim and Chris. Love the show and thanks for reading this email. On a quick side note, my parents actually considered naming me George, since I am born on February 22nd, which is the real George Washington's birthday.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's almost George. Okay, and then he said, alas, they did not, but I still have a fond connection to your use of the name George for all emailers to protect their..." And then he thought he would be funny. Mm-hmm. He wrote the word anonymity, and he put a line through it, and then he wrote next to it, privacy.
Privacy.
For those who don't know, I used to have difficulty pronouncing... I used to have difficulty pronouncing anonymity.
You
don't
say,
look at me that way.
Okay. You're considering you got it mastered now?
I ace it now. I can't say it fast.
Have
I
you
freely
heard
admit
anyone
that.
Say anonymity in their regular conversation?
Yeah, me.
Okay.
I did it somewhere.
Oh, you've got
I forget
it nailed.
Where I was.
And it just came out naturally?
No, I said it anonymity, and the people looked at me
like
I had four heads. Mm-hmm. I was like, hey, I just got to slow that word down.
Got it. Okay.
But before I mastered it, I couldn't even say anonymity, if you remember.
Oh, I remember.
And the other word there that the fish used to say, which the fish.
Abominable.
No, that's
that one?
Not that
the
one.
Fish?
I mastered
the fish
that
used
one,
to
too.
Say?
The fish. Remember, and someone from Texas was picking on me. Some talking fish from Nemo was saying some.
No, Dory?
I don't know their names.
Oh, anemone.
There.
Yeah, he lives in an anemone because he's a clownfish.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You haven't mastered that one yet?
Oh, hell no. That's when was the last time you used that word in a conversation? Anonymity you use a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But that other word, when was the last time you ever used that word?
Just now.
Okay. It's not a word I would master.
When I was at the fish store.
I didn't even know
I
what
said,
the hell
hey, look
that,
at that
word
nice,
means.
That look at that really pretty anemone.
I don't even know what that means. What is that, coral?
No, but it lives on coral, usually, in rocks.
Mm. All right. Okay, now, on to the fun stuff. Based on your shows that I listen to on iTunes, I'm investigating converting my one and only traditional IRA into a Roth IRA. But my Roth IRA has not been opened yet. Then he says, I am approximately 52, and my IRA has 140, and he put M. M to me is million.
Yeah.
K would be 140,000.
Yeah. Some people, small
I don't know
M
if
is 1,000 and
man,
big M is million.
He's got a big M.
It's a big M?
Yeah. So I don't know if he really means he has 140 million in this. This could be Mitt Romney.
Could be.
I don't know, folks.
Whether he does or not, I think the answer is the same, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we'll continue talking in millions here. But he says, I have one traditional IRA worth a total of $140 million. Of the $140 million...
That just sounds weird as you're saying it.
$102 million is non-deductible contributions. So it...
Mm-hmm. So he's got a bunch of... basis in there.
He does. Mm-hmm. If there's 102 million of basis in there. Now,
wow.
Again, I think he means thousands,
mm-hmm.
but M
good.
To me has always been million. Little K has been thousands. That's what I've done for hundreds
of
thousands.
I agree, but there are places I've seen that they use small M or an M when they really mean what we call thousands.
Okay.
But it's other cultures usually.
Oh, well, I don't know. Okay. The traditional IRA has not been funded with any other source of income. And then he goes, I'm still working, and I have verified that my employer's 401k will accept the non-taxed funds, i.e. earnings, in my traditional IRA.
Oh, beautiful.
And he said there's $38 million of earnings.
Perfect.
So he's got 102 million of non-deductible contributions, which I think is 102,000 of non-deductible contributions, and 38,000 or 38 million if he's really good
of growth.
Of growth. So he's asking, my plan is to do a direct distribution, but you actually mean rollover, a direct transfer, let's put it that way, from my IRA to the 401k custodian who will only accept the 38 million or 1,000 in earnings. So far, so good.
Yep.
This should only leave 102 million or 102,000 of non-deductible contributions in my traditional IRA. I then intend to open a Roth IRA at the same custodian and move the 102 million from the traditional IRA to my brand new Roth IRA. This will leave a zero balance in my traditional IRA, but I think I might keep it open in case I want to put money in it later.
Genius.
I have a few snags. Upon looking at my paperwork, I have 8 years over the past 24 years where I did not file 8606 with my annual tax return. I do have all paperwork showing that all my contributions to the traditional IRA were done as non-deductible and the value of the IRA on December 31st of each year. This will allow me to fill in the blanks and show my progression of non-deductible contributions, aka basis, into my traditional IRA up to today's basis of 102 million. Which again, I think he means 102,000.
Yep.
My only concern is, I don't think, and I could be totally wrong, I would have to have gone, I'm surprised I didn't do this. Usually I get a little geeky on this. To go back 24 years, look what the maximum contribution he could have made each year for 24 years is. I don't think it's going to add up to 102,000. I don't.
Oh, I think it might. If he's contribution amounts, all
contribution amounts were at 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 for a long time, Chris.
Yeah, but they were 4,500 and 5,000 for a long time.
But to get to 102,000?
24 years, that's only, that's over 4,000.
But a lot of the, I'd say at least half of those 24 years, he probably couldn't have put in more than 5,000 a year. And some years more than 3,000 a year.
Right, but it only has to average about a little over about 4,500.
To get to 102?
Yeah.
All right. So I think that's solved. He's talking
but
thousands,
but I'm surprised
not
somebody put 24 years worth of non-deductible contributions. That just seems a little strange, but...
Well, I'm just saying what he says.
Yeah.
My question is, what is the best way to inform the IRA of this situation and provide...
IRS or IRA?
IRS of this situation and then present the proper paperwork. Can I do this myself? How do I fix my 8606? The good news is you're going to fix it wicked easily.
It's easy, yeah.
8606, first of all, 8606, for those who don't know, is the form this gentleman needed to file every year that he put non-deductible money into his IRA. He admits over the last 24 years, he said he fully funded his IRA with non-deductible contributions every year for 24 years, but he missed 8 years of filing 8606. And he's worried that that's going to screw up because chances are, folks, he is going to get audited on this. He's going to get a letter audit on this. He's going to move $38,000 of earnings into a 401k. That will generate a 1099, but he'll be able to document that it went into the 401k because the 401k will issue a 5498 in May, attesting to the fact that it received this money. And it will be documented as a rollover anyways because it's going to be done as a direct transfer. But the $102,000 that he has, when he converts that, he's going to receive a 1099 that is all taxable. because it's going into a Roth as a conversion from an IRA. But when he does his taxes, he's going to declare none of it taxable because he's saying it's all basis that is left. And how he proves that, how he proves that is Form 8606. Form 8606 is the form he would have been filing every year. And it would show a basis of 102 if he was doing it right. So he would say to the IRS, look at my 8606, 102,000 of basis. Go back and look at it. All my worksheets are there on how I came up with that. And I moved 102,000. He'll still get a letter audit probably. And then he'll just say, look, what I ended up doing is look at this other paperwork where I moved 38,000 of growth into my 401k. But it's against the law for me and against the law for the 401k to accept anything except the growth. So all my after-tax contributions had to stay in the IRA. That's what he's going to end up telling him, and that's exactly what's happening here. And then he says, but now I decided to convert my IRA, and lo and behold, it's only after-tax money in it, so I don't owe any taxes. That's what he's going to have to defend. He's wondering how he makes up the missing 8 years. My answer, listener, don't freaking worry about it. Whatever your last 8606 that has been filed and accepted, if it's been more than 3 years, is the 8606 the government's going to work, going to use. 8606 is a rolling document. Right. The beginning balance is the previous 8606's ending balance. And as Ed Slott says, in his opinion, the IRS doesn't even keep copies of all those old 8606s. They just take the latest 8606 you have. So if one of the missing 8606s is the latest one, what I would do is file a new 8606 with your taxes and have it to reflect the $102,000 that you are claiming is basis.
And keep all your records.
Right.
Because if they start asking
email,
questions about it, you might have to prove it.
You said in your email you've got all these records, so save them. And if you do get audited on it, you would send them all your records and say, hey, look through this. You'll see it all. But be forewarned, every year you don't file 8606 is a $100 penalty. So if you missed 8 years, you theoretically have an $800 penalty that the IRS may hit you with just to show you that they can do it. if you ever get audited for and you don't have your latest 8606. But it's a running document. So just file If you haven't filed one, if one of the eight is the last one and it's changed since the one before that, then you might want to file it. If the last 8606 is correct and it was previous ones, like year 8, 18, 27, 32, well, it wouldn't be that much because it only did 24 years. But if it was eight previous ones, not the last one, I don't think you need to update your 8606 at all. You've got all the data. The last one is the most accurate and reflects the 102,000. So I would just keep that 8606. That would be if that's the one that's correct.
Yeah, I went and looked at the contribution limits over the years, and this might be a hypothetical question he's posed to us because it looks to me like you'd have to put in all of the contributions as well as lately makeup contributions to get to the 102, but you could get there if you maxed out and every dollar, if you never deducted a dollar you were putting into your IRA, you might be able to get there at 102.
Okay, so it's theoretical.
So it is possible, but it seems a little bit strange.
Well, I mean, people can do it. You never know. Maybe he always made too much money, never could deduct it.
And couldn't put it in a Roth because he made too much money.
Well, Roth didn't come around to 98.
Yeah, I know, but in 98 he didn't switch to it because he couldn't, maybe.
Because he made too much?
Yeah, maybe.
It's possible.
It's possible.
So, well, it solved the question. He's talking 102,000, not 102 million.
That can't buy. There's no way he's got 102 million of contributions in there.
The only way I would have figured that would have been from prefunding a 401k or something from multiple employers. But Mitt Romney allegedly has 100 something million. Remember when he was running?
Yeah, but that was a rollover.
But, well, anyways, he could have got that as a rollover. Mm-hmm. But that said, it is possible that he could do it. But listener, don't worry about 8606. They take the last one you filed. If the last one you filed is right, I don't think you need to update anything because the last one is right. You don't go back and fix missed 8606s. And as Ed says, he doubts they even have them. They're going to go from the last 8606. Mm-hmm. But keep all your records. Because if you ever do get a letter audit, you're going to have to prove it. And then be prepared. They might hit you with penalties for never filing some of your 8606. I believe, if memory serves me correct, it's $100 for missing the 8606.
Yep.
All right.
Okay. Well, with that being said, we did knock out 5 questions today. Show went a little bit long, but at least we knocked out 5. It's a, you know, glass half full look. But if you're interested in what we do here, we do specialize in retirement planning. We are practicing financial planners with the focus on retirement planning. And if you're interested in more of what we do and what services we offer and our approach to retirement planning, if you listen to the podcast regularly, you'll get a sense for our philosophy and our approach to retirement planning. But if you want to chat with us a little more, we offer what's called a coffee and a second opinion, where you can get us on the phone. We'll talk to you for 30 to 60 minutes and describe what we do. We'll take a listen to what your questions and concerns might be and what you're looking to do with your retirement planning. And if we seem to be a good fit, then we can move forward. And otherwise, we can hopefully help you find some resources that will help you in your particular circumstances. So if you want to connect with us, the best way to do that is on the website jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. See a contact form on there with a phone number. You can reach out to us with a phone call. You can also send us an email, or there's a contact form. And occasionally, when it's working properly, I think it is right now, there's a an app where you can actually book a coffee and a second opinion appointment on a calendar right there on the website itself. But if you can't get that to work, just do it the old-fashioned way. Give us a call or send out an email to us, and we'll get right back to you. So thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.